Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. My guest today is Mark Gilmartin. I've known Mark for about 10 years, and on the 18th, I heard him give a wonderful talk about working with erotically conflicted men when desire and disgust collide. Mark, I think that the quote from Jack Moran is really good and a way to open the show. If you go to war with your sexuality, you're bound to lose. Yep. And you said that in your talk. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thank you, Diane. It's lovely to be back again on the show with you.
Good. I'm so glad. And you have worked with men and with out-of-control sexual behavior since 2000. You use a sexual health approach, and you don't usually, correct me if I'm wrong, you don't usually use the word sexual addiction, or you do, but maybe explain that for us, please.
I don't use that term, but clients will use that term. It's become very popular in our culture to use that phrase to describe a certain set of symptoms. So when a client brings that term to me, I don't oppose them initially because I'm trying to understand what they're telling me. If they decide to work with me and to be treated, then gradually I'll introduce other language to describe those symptoms that's a little different than sex addiction. But that is the kind of the umbrella term of most of the clients that I work with.
Yes, and with the Me Too movements being so strong, I'm wondering if, because we're going to discuss consent and why it's so important, have you had an uptick in your group attendance, maybe female partners sending the guy in for help? You had more group members?
Yeah, in my line of work, the flow of business remains pretty steady. I actually have not noticed a difference. But I think with the Me Too movement, you're dealing with people that actually would fall under that umbrella of non-consent, the men that are actually not getting consent from the women or the men they're engaging. And so I think I think there probably is an uptick in folks that are being referred for consultations or for assessments that have engaged across some kind of boundary, a sexual boundary. For example, not getting someone's permission before sending them explicit photos of themselves, these kinds of things. Because I don't work with any non-consensual sexual health issues, I haven't actually seen an uptick.
I see. That's interesting. You, as I think I said at the opening of the show, you have worked with this population of conflicted men since 2000. Has your group changed in any way? Has it, or a lot of the same themes showing up?
Well, one of the trends that I've noticed, and this may be because I'm located in a slightly more conservative part of the Seattle area, is that for a lot of the years I did the group, it was a predominantly heterosexual group. And I think over time there was a point in time where the group actually transitioned into being mostly gay men, that was a really interesting phenomenon to sit with. To see the heterosexual men being the minority, the sexual minority in the room, and how they manage that. But the group has come back to a balance. It's probably a good mix, probably about 50-50, close to 50-50. I've also seen a little bit of expansion as far as the relationship configurations that come in. I typically have a couple of married men that are in the group, but sometimes now I'm having same-sex married folks that are in the room, legally married to their same-sex partners. I've got folks that are in solo. They're living as single people, and they're quite contentedly so. I've also had folks that were living in other kinds of configurations, like throuples. A throuple is where you have two primary partners, and they're all living together, and they're sharing space together. So I've seen an expansion, I think, as far as the relationship configurations that are coming in, and that's been really exciting. I've always been an advocate of a lot of diversity in my groups. I like diversity in age, of ethnicity, of sexual interests, relationship configurations. I find that really interesting, and I think it's a great way for the men to learn from each other so they see the crossover where there are similarities, and they also see the differences. So it can expand their worldview and their perspectives a bit to sit with other men that live lives differently than they do.
The group process can be very powerful because when one person is working, so can another.
That's
just
right.
By listening, and some people in your group may be a little. Do you have a time limit when they come in, or they can just be there for once they're accepted into the group?
Coming into this group, the group that I run actually has two clinical populations, and the first is men that have that. Actually, all of the men in my group are erotically conflicted in some way, which is our topic today. But some of them have an obsessive or a compulsive nature to their sexuality, so they're wanting to learn how to manage their sexual impulses differently. And some of the men are just conflicted; they're not struggling with restraining their urges. They're just conflicted. So the men that come in, there's a six-month initial commitment, and then the men will stay in for anywhere from probably 18 months to 5 years or more, depending on the level of change that they're seeking.
So you must have some men then in your group that have been there long-term, and I'm wondering if you can describe what you have seen in terms of perhaps transformation in these men when they've been in the group a long time.
Sure. Yeah, what I see is I see there's a two-part process for the men that come into the group to deal with their erotic conflicts. And the first part is really managing the behaviors that have spun out of control. So learning how to regulate their moods, learning how to resist these urges that they have, learning how to keep agreements with their employer, with themselves, with their partners. That's kind of the first, the initial process they're in, and that can take anywhere from 6 months to maybe a couple of years, depending on the level of struggle they're having. And then the second part of the process is when they've got that under control, it's beginning to really consider what kind of sexual life do they want to have, and if they're intentional about the sexuality they want to experience, what does that look like? You know, we live in a culture where we're encouraged to think about the kind of partner we want to live with, the kind of house we want to have, the career we want to have. But we're not a culture that says, what's your vision of sexual health? What do you see yourself doing as an adult where you're living with your own values, within your own values, and you're experiencing pleasure? What does that look like? So this is a place where they get to have, paradoxically, they get to go through that process and begin to think about, you know, what's the vision that they work on formulating in the beginning of treatment. And then the second half of group is really learning how to begin living that vision. So that's what the second half of group is. And some men will take that quite a ways. They'll get very specific and very motivated to really embody that vision. And so when they leave group, it's very much a celebration. Hurting people in their lives. They're no longer violating these implicit and explicit agreements that they've made. So it's really a celebration when somebody graduates and leaves the group, and it's very inspiring, especially to the newer members, to see and to hear about what it was like for them to start the group in such distress and now be leaving the group so happy about their sexual lives and so comfortable with their sexuality. It's a nice inspiration for the newer members, and even for the midterm members, to remember, you know, you too can have this.
You too can have this. And especially another important point to make here is that so many of your members come in with a lot of shame. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. I think growing up in this culture, there's a lot of shame because children especially grow up with such natural curiosity about themselves, about their bodies, about sexuality, and they really have nowhere to go to ask about this because we're so phobic in talking about sexuality to children. We don't want to imagine that children have sexual feelings or think about sexual things. You know, it's funny when you hear a comedian telling a story about having a crush on a teacher in third or fourth grade. It's a great representation that these things are active and alive, even in young children, and even in babies in utero. We have sonograms now where you can go and look and see little babies pleasuring themselves, you know, masturbating.
Including little girl babies.
Exactly, especially little girl babies.
Especially
because I think so often that women's sexuality doesn't get the same kind of focus and attention that men's does. I think women's sexuality gets left out a lot. So that's why we're saying especially. I mean, really, just equally, but just because there's so much more, there's a kind of a gender disparity in how we, you know, we talk to little boys about sex and the way we, you know, or the way we sort of expect that little boys are going to do things, and we don't expect that of little girls. I think it's really not reasonable.
But we are really born sexual beings,
mm-hmm.
And what's so sad, and you mentioned this in your talk, what gets left out of sex education? Pleasure. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about pleasure and healthy sexuality, and I love that you emphasize healthy sexuality. How much better our lives would be if we could enjoy sexual pleasure mm-hmm. without all of the overlays that the culture brings us.
Right. Yeah, and I think especially when we're talking about kids, which is really where a lot of this begins, a lot of the erotic mm-hmm. conflicts happen, or they're germinated, I think, in childhood. So if you think mm-hmm. about a gay boy or a lesbian girl, you know, they look around and see these heterosexist norms, that, you know, you should pair off with the opposite sex, you should get a Valentine from the opposite sex, you should want to go steady with somebody of the opposite sex. So imagine you've got a little boy or a little girl who's in the fifth or sixth grade around the time when they're developing crushes, and they're not having crushes on the opposite sex. They're having
mm-hmm.
crushes on the same sex. So there's
mm-hmm.
there's a conflict right there for them. They're going to be looking around thinking, I'm not like most everybody else. Why am I different? And why is nobody talking to me about this? And how do I understand this? So you can see how some of these conflicts start early. But your point about pleasure, I think one of the concerns that parents have about talking to children about sexual pleasure is this idea that you'll be introducing children to something that's too early. It's premature. They're not emotionally ready to understand these concepts. And it might motivate them to begin sexual experimentation earlier than you'd like them to. I think the conversations about pleasure with kids are going to be more beneficial if they start by talking about sensory pleasure. So this can be things like really mirroring back to them when you see them eating a particular food that they like. Maybe they love a particular flavor of ice cream, and the
mm-hmm.
texture of the ice cream, the flavor of the ice cream, the crunchiness as they're eating it. Or it could be the way they get their hair brushed. You know, they like a particular brush, and they like it brushed a particular way. This is when I think you begin to introduce children to the idea of sensory pleasure, that their body can experience pleasure, whether it's taste, whether it's something that they see, it's a smell, it's tactile, it's something they experience on their skin. These can be the beginnings of helping children become more comfortable with their body and their body's response, and this can set up a nice platform to eventually introduce conversations about sexual pleasure when they're appropriate, when they're age-appropriate, and the child is old enough to be able to understand these concepts. But yes, this is definitely something that I include in my work with these clients. I have a big poster, actually, in my office, and it's got six principles of sexual health, and number four is pleasure. And what I'll tell my clients when they come in, I'll sometimes say, I said this not long ago, actually, to a client, I said, you've got the pleasure principle down, don't you? And he said, yeah. And I said, the problem is that you don't know how to experience pleasure, which is also in alignment with your sexual values. And I said, that's, I think, why you're here to talk to me. You want to be able to experience sexual pleasure, but you want to feel good about yourself afterwards. That's really the net effect of acting or behaving in a way that's congruent with our values. the end point is you walk away from the experience and you say, oh, that was amazing. That felt so good.
Yes.
And there's no regret.
Yes.
There's no shame. There's no remorse. There's no second guessing. There's no disappointment. There's just a sense of, wow, that was great. I can't wait to do that again. So I like to give clients a little bit of a vision also of you know, what they're aiming towards, because they know what it's like to experience pleasure that ends with all the negative feelings. But they don't often know what it's like, but they like the idea. You can see it in their eyes. They'll look at me with this look that says, is that possible? Boy, I love the sound of that. And so it's very motivating for them when they hear that these things are actually within reach.
Within reach. I'm so glad that you have these groups, and I can understand why you have when a guy graduates, there is a celebration because he's been transformed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I
very
should
possibly.
Say I didn't say this in the beginning. I only work with men. I'd love it if somebody out there, if we had a clinician that said, I want to learn how to work with erotically conflicted women, because I'm sure they're out there. And there's a need for that. But just to be clear in our talk today, I don't work with women. I don't work with transgendered individuals, just with men. That's the population that I'm working with.
I think that's good, because you can focus in on the male issues, and you don't have to be all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Many years ago now, I co-led two women's sexuality groups in California for about 8 years, and I was a co-therapist with a Dr. Maria Flaherty, and these were not erotically conflicted women, though. These were women who had some form of sexual trauma or abuse, and they were having difficulties, usually most of them with orgasm.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we had the same thing. It was sort of open-ended, and so when a woman would leave, there was a celebration because she now could have sex without all the conflicts and reach orgasm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful.
And that's a breakthrough.
That must have been so
many.
Nice to see that happen for those women.
I don't have the time now to do a group, but I know firsthand, because I did it for 5-6 years, the value of group work.
Mm-hmm.
It's very powerful.
Yeah.
Very
yeah.
powerful.
I wanted to make another comment about what you said about consent earlier, because I think in the clinical world of treating erotically conflicted men, there's actually a number of different treatment approaches, and there isn't a consensus about this topic of consent. So I think it's worth circling back to for a minute and making mention. The reason that I make a distinction is because when you're working with a man who has non-consensual sexual impulses, so these could be things like peeping through windows, exposing oneself in public, rubbing up against people in public without their permission or consent, spying on people, using the bathroom. These are all, looking at images of child sexuality, child pornography. These are all examples of non-consensual sexual behavior. And some of the treatment modalities that treat erotically conflicted men will lump together the consensual issues with the non-consensual issues. And I think this is really a problem. I've heard firsthand, actually, from many of my clients who have been in groups or gone to meetings where they've been sitting next to somebody who maybe raped somebody or had been arrested, had a parole officer, and they're a little bewildered because they think, I would never do something like that. I'm not sure what I'm doing in this room. So there's a problem from the client's perspective, but I think also from the treatment provider's perspective. When you're working with a non-consenter, you're dealing with a very different characterological structure. You have to have the capacity to minimize and rationalize the harm that you're causing, to make it make sense in your own head why you can be exploitive, why you can do these things that can be so damaging. And there's a specific category of clinicians that have been trained, sex offender treatment providers. I wish they had a different name, because even mentioning their name is it's hard to get a buy-in from a client to go have a consultation with somebody with that title. But those are the people that are really trained with the specialty to understand how to work with that particular mindset. So I just want to underscore in my mind what anybody that at least passes the they're within the sort of the benchmark of everything they're doing is consensual, there's a huge range of what people can do. It may not be everything that I would be interested in or understand, and there might even be some things that seem a little out there for me, but it doesn't matter. As long as they're consensual, you know, I'm just working with consensual issues. So I just wanted to underscore that point because it's not always clear to the general public the difference between consent and non-consent. And some of the more public cases that we that come up, you know, the Tiger Woods, the David Duchovny's, the Elliot Spitzers, you know, these folks that get in the media's they get the media's attention. Oftentimes the public doesn't know, well, was there something non-consensual? Was it consensual? And then client spouses will sometimes wonder, you know, are our children safe? And they'll have concerns about potential non-consensual behavior when I think it's our job as clinicians to educate the public about the difference and why different treatment methods are necessary and why they don't need to be worried about things escalating. We really don't have research that shows us that consensual sexual behaviors will escalate to non-consensual. So I think it's important that we as clinicians are clear about that.
Sounds like you are, and I know from being in some supervision groups with you that you're very, very clear and very effective. You're a very effective sex therapist and group therapist, and I mean, just in the way that you're expressing all of this is demonstrates that. And so that's really important. So. What can you talk a little more about sexual values, because I'm sure you go over that in your group.
Mm-hmm,
what sure. What are the person's sexual values?
Yeah, it's a very important topic. So sexual values is something that it just doesn't get discussed nearly enough. So if I gave you a definition of sexual values, it would be something like a person's beliefs, attitudes, or feelings about sex or sexuality. And sexual values are typically, if you talk to most people, sexual values are inherited, meaning that we really just get our sexual values from the culture we grow up in, the families we grow up in, maybe the faith communities that we grow up in, and we just sort of kind of absorb them from the homes that we live in and the churches that we go to and the communities we live in, and they're typically not questioned too much. When they get questioned often is when they're coming in for treatment because they're now engaged in some kind of behavior that violates a sexual value. Although the client may not know that initially, that what they're doing, they may just know they feel guilty or they feel bad when they do something. And when you talk it out, they may come to some kind of clarity such as one of their values is they don't want to be exchanging money for sexual experiences. That may be a value that was sort of intrinsic for them, but they'd never really thought it out or articulated it. Or it may be that they don't want to look at images of people having sexual experiences online unless their partner has given them consent or unless there's an agreement within their relationship that's going to be okay. That may be another example of clarifying a sexual value. So it's something that I wish was part of our sex ed program, really inviting kids and probably more likely preteens and teens to think about what is a sexual value and what are your sexual values? Can you identify them, you know, and are your parents' sexual values the same sexual values that you want to have? So here's where you might look at topics like monogamy or relationship configurations. If you have a gay or lesbian teen, they may have parents whose sexual values say that sex is only acceptable within a married heterosexual relationship. Well, they might say, I want to live with my partner. I don't want to get married, and I want to have sex. So that might be an example of a different value. Or they might say, I think I'm going to be loving somebody of the same sex. That's a different value than my parents or grandparents had. And so it will be good for them to be able to clarify that and be able to differentiate that so that they don't have conflicted feelings when they actually go into that relationship.
And do you, in the group, if you have a homosexual man, do you help that individual come out to certain people if they haven't done it? And how to do it? I mean, is that part of the group work?
I'm trying to think. You know, that's a great question. I'm thinking over the course of the group has been running now for about 10 years, so I'm trying to think if I've had somebody who wasn't out. I don't know that I've had somebody not out in the group. I think really just by virtue of joining a group, you're coming out, because in the process of coming into the group, you have to talk about your vision of sexual health, your sexual health plan, which includes the boundaries, the sexual boundaries you've set for yourself, and identifying the things that are high risk for you that might lead you to crossing a sexual boundary. And in the process of having those discussions, I don't think you can avoid the pronouns. I think you can only use they for so long, but if you wanted to avoid using he, if you're, in the room, I think that would get hard after a while. So I think if somebody's mm-hmm. agreeing to come into the group, at some point they would, well, probably, fairly soon they'd need to acknowledge that, they have a same-sex partner, or they're gay or something like that. I think it would come out sooner as opposed to later.
So that's a big source of an erotic conflict.
It definitely can be. It definitely mm-hmm. can be. I had a client at one point who was, he worked in a very kind of hyper-masculine industry where there was an expectation of heterosexuality, and he was gay, and he also had a presentation of being, you, if you'd met this man, you would have no idea that he was gay. There was, mm-hmm. when I say gay, I would say there's nothing, he wasn't feminine acting in any way,
mm-hmm.
would be a better way to put it. I think there are plenty of men that, I don't know that looking gay, I mean, that's really more around how we think about some men that are more feminine acting, we think of them as gay. I don't think that's an accurate representation, because I know plenty of heterosexual men that are feminine acting that are quite heterosexual. But this man really struggled, I think, in sort of reconciling those two worlds, and did have an experience at one point where he was almost outed by a colleague at a work conference. So I guess that has happened. There has been a case of that. But the man was out in the group. He just wasn't out in the world. And he would talk about, because his industry didn't really support that. So it was, he had to live a little bit of a dual life, but he actually managed it fairly well.
Dual life.
Mm-hmm.
But the group, no doubt, helped him manage it, because I can imagine, in fact, I've had clients here and there, that's a big source of shame if they have to keep all these secrets,
right,
about their sexuality.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How do you respond? We both really admire Jack Moore and miss him. I think he died about maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I think about 2013. It was a terrible loss.
Terrible. I mean,
yeah.
His book, The Erotic Mind, the big takeaway from The Erotic Mind for me, and I read it probably 20 years ago, is his erotic formula is attraction plus obstacles equals excitement.
Mm-hmm.
Can you expand on that from the point of view of your groups or even your individual clients?
Yeah, let me think about that question for a minute. There's a sense of when we have, it makes me also think about his cornerstone. He's got these cornerstones of eroticism, and one of his cornerstones is the violating prohibitions cornerstone. It's the idea mm-hmm. that some things are really sexually appealing because they're naughty, they're taboo,
uh-huh.
they're awful.
Uh-huh.
So it reminds me of that statement a little bit. I think in regards to the work that I do with clients, I've never really considered that thought. It's my clients are a little more conflicted around. It's not so much attraction plus obstacle makes it exciting. I think it's more they don't know how to reconcile, you know, having the pleasure and doing it in a way that aligns with their own sexual integrity. So I think it's a little bit different.
Yeah.
I think there probably is something that gets charged for them in the fact that they maybe feel like they shouldn't be doing this, or that it's forbidden, or that their partner would really get upset. But I think by the time they get to me, that's not so much a driving force for them anymore. They're really tired, and maybe there's been a discovery by their partner of like a secret email account or a stash of sexual imagery or a secret credit card, or maybe there's been a disclosure where the client decided to fess up and say, this is what I've been doing, I want to stop. I think by that time, it's not so much attraction plus obstacle. I think it's more, I want to learn how to honor and keep these agreements that I've made, and be able to enjoy my sexuality in a way where I don't feel bad about it afterwards.
That's a very good point. Mark, you tend to use the term sexual imagery rather than pornography. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, I'm a big fan of trying to invite clients to be as honest and transparent and as vulnerable as they can be. And I think that the language we use really has an impact in the therapy room. So when clients come in, oftentimes they're bringing a lot of their own shame, their own embarrassment. Sometimes you're the first person that they might have talked to about these things. And so I don't want to layer on top of all that a language that's going to evoke even more feelings that might shut them down or might make them less communicative or bring more feelings into the room. I'm really trying to make lots of space in the room for them to be as comfortable as possible talking about things that are just naturally going to make them uncomfortable. So I like to use more value-neutral language. And that's language that's really descriptive and clear, but it doesn't have any societal or cultural associations that influence how the listener experiences the particular word. So if you say the word porn, pornography, that word is not very neutral for most folks. Now, if you're one of the rare people that hears that word and you think, oh yeah, okay, you have no kind of visceral response, you're really an outlier, and good for you. I'm happy you don't have that. But most of us have some kind of association with that word. So rather than using the word porn, I probably would use a word like sexual imagery, sexually explicit material, adult entertainment, something that takes a minute for the client to think about. Now, what is he? Oh, he's talking about porn. Okay. So they get to the same conclusion, but their brain doesn't have an affective response because of the particular word. It's the same with the word masturbation. I think that's an extremely charged word. And So I rarely will use that word with clients because it takes clients back to being in junior high or being at home, being caught by one of their parents, being teased at school.
Yes.
There's nothing really very neutral about that word. So I would rather use the word solo sex or self-pleasuring, something, again, that's very descriptive, but it doesn't evoke any negative feelings for the client. Negative feelings.
Yes. The men in your group, I bet quite a few of them have recalled and discussed in the group their feelings of shame and embarrassment when they were discovered, masturbating or solo sex. And it lingers. So that's been my experience with clients. They'll never get over, but they have trouble getting over it. Mm-hmm. And then it, depending upon the adult's reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And
Yeah, I think part of it is has to do with the treatment of shame. You know, you're bringing up kind of a bigger mm-hmm. topic, which is how do you treat shame? And mm-hmm. in my belief, shame is like something that's sort of festering and moldy and smelly, and shame needs air and light to dissipate. And I think the way that people release shame, clients release shame, is by telling their stories and staying in their bodies, continuing to breathe, and having a witness to their experiences. This is where individual therapy and group therapy can be really cathartic for folks that actually might have a lot of shame, to tell a story and to not be laughed at, to not be ridiculed, to not have the shame reinforced, to not have expressions of disdain look back at them as they're telling. When I watch clients tell stories in my group, I see looks of compassion and understanding of brotherhood. And so the more clients, I think, tell their story, eventually the shame starts to lighten and lift. And then over time, I think there's much less shame there. So it's a great question. I think it speaks to, you know, how do we help clients rid themselves of shame? And I think telling their stories in safe, you know, kind of affirming environments is a wonderful way to help clients get rid of their shame.
And because I do a lot of couples counseling, and so I often have women of whose partners do watch porn, mm-hmm. sexual imagery, and
good, you caught yourself. Great.
No, I purposely said that because I use it mostly, and because,
okay.
But I understand why you don't.
Yeah.
But anyway, these women will say things like, "He has a secret life. I feel left out. It's something I just don't understand. I feel inadequate compared to porn."
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting one, and I often explain that guys and if the partner is there. Well, he'll often confirm it, that he'd much rather be with a live person,
mm-hmm.
somebody who's living and breathing and responsive and isn't this sort of fantasy figure on the screen. But a little sidebar here, it's interesting that in some studies, men who have difficulty with premature ejaculation or rapid ejaculation, and to leave some of the values off, and erectile dysfunction often won't have it when they're watching porn and men masturbating. They won't have it because they're like in charge and mm-hmm. and they don't have to please the fantasy woman on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's a gay man, although gay men tend to be a little more, well, I'm generalizing. Let's just stick with heterosexual couples, right, for the
mm-hmm.
moment.
Mm-hmm.
If the woman says, "I feel inadequate compared to the porn, the woman on the screen," that'll open up a discussion, which is usually very fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
But women have trust issues. I trust him less. I'm afraid he's hooked. He's so defensive about it. This is the sort of thing I hear.
Yeah. Well, you're going back to the idea, you know, we talk about an erotic conflict, kind of the essence of an erotic conflict is it's either what I like sexually doesn't equal what I should like sexually, or
mm-hmm.
What I like sexually doesn't equal who I am sexually. So when somebody goes online to look at these explicit images, I'm always curious to find out, you know, what are you looking at? This is sometimes a question
mm-hmm.
that gets avoided by clinicians because it feels like it's intrusive, it's too personal. But I think it's really important to know what this is, what they're looking at. And so if I break down categories of erotic conflicts, there's four that I want to reference. One would be
okay.
Interpersonal conflicts. This is the conflict the man just has inside himself. It doesn't really involve others, but it's just his own conflict in his own mind and body. There's interpersonal
mm-hmm.
conflicts. This is him with his partner, his boss, his pastor, with God, with someone external to himself. There's
mm-hmm.
Sexual orientation conflicts. So this is
mm-hmm.
somebody's conflicted about, you know, the gender of who they're attracted to being sexual with. And then there's either unconventional turn-ons or fixed turn-ons. This is another category. When somebody has, this could be a reason that somebody goes online, which is, let's say they have a particular fetish. They love feet. And their partner isn't, you know, maybe they've alluded to this, maybe they've tiptoed around it, and their partner's maybe said something dismissive. Oh, who are those perverts that are just into feet? And he's thinking, well, me. Like, that's, I'm the pervert that's into feet. So he doesn't feel like he can go to her if this is a heterosexual couple. And so what he's looking at is very important. It may not be that actually what he wants is just the living, breathing partner. I think some of the times that's true, but if it's an unconventional turn-on or a fixed turn-on where the man needs a particular thing to be present in order to have his ejaculation and orgasm, he may have a lot of shame about owning that, acknowledging it, negotiating that with his partner. And maybe when he goes online, he can actually have that experience, and it's much easier and simpler for him. So it's we don't always know, you know, why he's going, why men are going online. If we're just talking about men, there's lots of reasons men go online, but there's a lot of good information to be you know, explored here.
For sure, and when I'm seeing a couple, and this is part of the kind of, in some cases, this is a centerpiece. They come in with he watches too much porn, and I want you to fix him.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Wiley.
And, the spousal referral.
What?
It's the spousal referral.
Yes, it is. And
yeah.
Spousal referral.
Says, I'll be back in an hour to pick him up, you know.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
And I say there's so much more here that we need to look at. This is not just fixed.
Right.
And a lot of guys don't realize that they're not going to talk their woman out of her distress.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to ridicule her out of it or bully her out of it or logic her out of it or even sweet-talk her out of it. You might get her to talk about it less, but you won't get her to feel less.
Mm-hmm.
This is a huge... huge part of some couple's relationship. Mm-hmm. And if guys come in alone and describe this problem, well, I've referred a few to you, but you have a long waiting list, but you are so competent about all of this, and it's
well, I've got
really
an advantage over you, too. I mean, it's really a different paradigm when a man is coming in one-on-one to talk to me. It's really a different animal when you have the couple in front of you. It's much more difficult. So if I'm sitting with a man, for example, and I, you know, rather than jumping in to some of these really intimate personal conversations, I might preface the conversation with a question about broaching the topic. So I might say something like, Larry, you know, what would it be like if I asked you to tell me more detail about where you go online, what you look at online? What would that be like if we had that conversation? Then Larry might start to say, well, and I'd say, no, let's not have that conversation yet. I want to first practice these sexual health principles and get your consent. Have you ever talked to anybody? Have you ever told anybody where you go online? Well, no, not really. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So what would it be like to tell me, you know, we're just getting to know each other. We're you're early in treatment. What would it be like to tell me about something that's such a personal and private part of your life? So Larry gets time to sort of, you know, he may not be ready. He might say, I'm not quite ready to talk about it. I say, good for you for being so clear. Let's table that for now. There's other things we can talk about. But he may not feel like that same freedom if he's in the office with you and his wife, and the wife says, yeah, Larry, what are you looking at? And there he is on the spot. And it's definitely, I think I have, it's a little easier one-on-one to do some of these explorations than if you have the couple sitting in front of you and all their dynamics.
Yeah. It's a different dynamic, and there's certainly a place for both, right?
Yeah.
The group and the individual. Back when I did the groups, I saw some of the women individually too, and the combination was often powerful. So,
I want to give you a couple examples of what an erotically conflicted man looks like. So you got some, your listeners have got some concrete ideas, so we can move out of the clinical concepts and we can actually start talking about what it actually looks like.
Yeah.
So one example would be men who are conflicted about their use of sexual imagery. This is probably one of the more common presentations that we see, which is men that come in and say, you know, my wife doesn't like it that I go online and I look at these sexual images. That's one example. Another would be men that are conflicted about the fact that they look at these images and they pleasure themselves at the same time. It could be men that have a turn-on that their partner dislikes. You know, we were talking about this a few minutes ago. This partner has discovered, here's this thing that's so sexually charged for him, and he's so embarrassed that he doesn't know how to talk to his partner about it, so he doesn't. He just finds his own outlet for this. Or it could be men that have a turn-on that they dislike themselves. Their partner might say, well, I'm fine with that. And he might say, but I'm disgusted by it. Like, this is, why do I like this? So he's confused about his own turn-ons.
Can you think of an example of that?
Right. So let's say you have a man who has, let's say maybe he's discovered that water sports, that's sexual activity that involves the use of urination. He's discovered that maybe just perusing videos, he stumbled on some videos where, let's say, he's watching women urinate on men, and he gets very turned on. But he's really embarrassed. He thinks, this is just disgusting. So the woman is basically, so she's evacuating her urine onto this man. He seems to really be enjoying it. She enjoys it, and he gets turned on by it, but he doesn't understand why is this such a turn-on, and he imagines that if he tells other people, they're going to look at him with disgust and tell him, what's wrong with you that you like something like that? And he might say, I don't know.
You're a pervert.
You're a pervert, right.
Yeah.
Who gets into that?
Yeah.
I think the world of BDSM and kink, this has gotten a lot more exposure with, you know, 50 Shades of Grey and the trilogy. But I still think that's a very marginalized sexual subculture where there's a lot of confusion about the difference between what I would call sensation play or the exchange of pain and what people would call the use of violence, sex and violence. You know, people within that community don't really use that language. They don't talk about violence. They talk about sensation or high sensation or pain exchange. But there's a lot of confusion. People look at that and they say, why would somebody want that? Or somebody's into what we call humiliation play, the idea of interacting with somebody in a way where they're belittling you, they're making fun of you, they're ridiculing you, and it actually is erotic for the person that's being humiliated. There's a lot of confusion in our world about what does that mean, and it's often labeled with pathology, that people look at that and say, there must be something wrong, there must be trauma there that hasn't been treated, rather than just recognizing, well, it looks like it's an erotic turn-on that seems to be getting consensually expressed in the videos this person is watching. So I think that's an example of where this could be another example where somebody, their partner might feel, disgusted by what they're doing, or the client might feel confused about, you know, what is it about sensation play or power exchange? You know, being somebody that gets to give up all their power and gets to be tied up and have somebody call all the shots, that can be confusing to folks that haven't been educated or haven't learned around what these things mean and why people are attracted to them.
I know there's still
been
have
a work some... to do here.
I'm sorry, say the last thing again.
I think we still have some work to do as a sex therapist to destigmatize some of these consensual sexual subcultures because, it's funny, you know, under off the radar, underground, people seek these things out and they find their colleagues and they have these experiences, but you don't see it talked about as much in the culture or in families or in relationships. We still have a lot of shame, I think, in especially here in Western culture around these things.
Mm-hmm. I remember a study that was reviewed in one of the sexual journals. This goes back maybe 4 or 5 years, and people doing the research found that those that were engaged in BDSM often were quite healthy because they had rules and they discussed them before, so they were good communicators.
Mm-hmm.
And so often couples don't talk very well about what they want, need, and desire. Can you say more about the BDSM people that are communicating well?
Sure. It's really an interesting paradox because this is still a quite marginalized sexual subculture and community. But in reality, it's one of the most sexually literate subcultures that exist out there, meaning that the people that get together, because of the kinds of play that they're engaging in, they have to be extremely clear with each other about what they want to do, how they want to do it, who they want to play with, potentially the dialogue that might occur between them, the length of time that they want to have their sexual scene last, what they want to do for aftercare. And aftercare refers to a period of time when you're done with the sexual part of the scene and the person might just be resting or recovering or sort of coming down from the intense pleasure they've experienced. And so aftercare would be how the other person takes care of them, maybe gets them a little bite to eat or some water. Maybe they sit with them or they hold them. They have to negotiate all these things and talk about these things. Where are these things going to happen? And so as a result of the kinds of experiences they want to have, they're forced to be really good communicators. And I think it's a paradox that in some ways that we marginalize that community, you know, as a culture, and we sort of frown and say, I don't know about those BDSM folks. But in reality, they're the folks that should be teaching us because, you know, they're very literate, they're very articulate, and they're also very protective. You know, they look out for each other. They're actually mm-hmm. very solid communities. They screen people that come into their communities. If somebody comes in and is not playing by the rules or they're not following the protocols, they get banished. You know, they get sent out, and people get notified about not being allowed in. They're not allowed back in to play in those communities. They're very protective of their membership. So it is unfortunate, but it's a bit of a paradox that, you know, we have this impression of how that world looks, and in reality, they've figured out some things that I think the rest of us could benefit from.
I agree with you. And one of the things about the 50 Shades of Grey, the books and the movies, and we all have complaints about how they were written and the movies weren't that good, but it got conversations going.
It did.
And
yeah.
And that was, I guess that all came out in about 2012. Mm-hmm. And so it's always healthy, I think, to, that's why I have this show, get conversations going and get it out on the table and let's talk.
Yes, yes, right.
Yeah, it's really important, you know, the joke that, it's not a joke, but what's a four-letter word that if more couples did it more often, they'd have a healthier sex life? And
oh,
it's
I haven't
not
heard
F-U-C.
Joke. I like it.
It's not F-U-C-K. It's
T-A-L-K. T-A-L-K.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
yep.
it. And so, and that's, of course, you know this, but that's one reason that people come to see sex therapists. They don't have a language for sexuality, and so they benefit from the sex therapist being at ease.
Mm-hmm.
With the whole subject and has a language, you know, and if they grew up with parents who gave names, like instead of penis, they'd say pee-pee or, you know, all these other things that kind of the underlying theme is your genitals are not, you don't need to talk about them straight ahead forward.
Mm-hmm.
And use the proper terminology. So that's another way that therapists can be a model. Mm-hmm. Use the proper terminology and do it with ease.
Mm-hmm.
Which reminds me of a small study of sex therapists. And so the idea was that the question that motivated the study was, do sex therapists have better sex lives than the general population?
Mm.
And in this small study, they said yes, because sex therapists can often or usually have sex without anxiety,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, under that is shame and all of that, mm-hmm. because of the knowledge piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got books filled with sexuality and in our libraries and all kinds of things. And so we're more comfortable talking about it and then maybe doing it just because we don't. So are you aware of that study, the sex therapy?
No, I love that study. That's interesting. It doesn't surprise me. I could see how just, you know, being comfortable with the topic and also being comfortable with talking about it, using language and communicating needs, setting limits, being open, being sexually curious, maybe being experimental. I could see having the capacity to not be overwhelmed or freaked out if a partner brings up something that's sort of new or different. So being less reactive, I think, is probably something they also bring to the table. But it's not, that's not a surprising result to hear about. I wanted to leave your readers with a couple of resources that might be helpful for them.
Good. And but before we go any further, because we often stop a couple of minutes before the top of the hour.
Okay.
What's the best way for people to get more information about you?
People want to reach me, they can go to my website, which is www.markgilmartin.com. That's MarcGilMartin. And they can also contact me through the website. That would be a great way to reach me as well.
Yes, and you have that all up on your website. I know you do. So, yes, say what you were going to say, because it probably is a pretty good summary of our conversation today.
Yeah, I just wanted to give, so just back to the idea of an erotic conflict, it's this synergy between I want, I don't want. These are the clients that come in, and they're really struggling with how to reconcile the wanting something but not wanting sort of to have to pay the price that goes with the pursuit of pleasure. And I think we have great treatment modalities for treating these, for working with the ambivalence that often comes with erotic conflicts. So we have great treatment modalities. A couple great books for clients, Mostly Straight by Rich Seven Williams, is a great study of male sexual fluidity. So is Is My Husband Gay, Straight, or Bisexual by Joe Court. I think these are really interesting ways to look at some of those things. I appreciate your
Mark,
time,
Diana. That's our music, so that means we have to end the show. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Great to talk to you again.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.